WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Now, I'm a little verklempt about this, but I'm going to close up today talking with an old friend. I got to the New Yorker in 1992, and when I arrived, Mary Norris was already something of a legend. She had joined the magazine in 1978, and she rose through the ranks to become something we call an okayer. It's a little hard to describe what it is, but it's sort of like copy editing raised to the level of an art or a monastic discipline. A few years back, Mary set aside everyone else's writing to work on a book of her own. It was about why we mess up our own language so much and how to mess up a little less. It was called Between You and Me, Confessions of a Comma Queen. For a book mostly about grammar, it was a hit. And with that, Mary Norris began thinking about retirement. So 18 years ago, I was lucky enough to start my job as editor. And the one thing that I distinctly remember happening the first couple of weeks is I read the fiction that we had available. I didn't much love it. And at that time, I was reading a novel by Philip Roth called I Married a Communist. And I suggested to the fiction editor at the time, Bill Buford, that we run an excerpt of this Philip Roth novel, I Married a Communist, and it eventually ran as an excerpt, as a story called Communist, I believe. And you worked on it. What happened?
Okay, that was I Married a Communist. I think that was one of the first things that Roth had ever read. But of course, I was intimidated. That copy was beautiful because it was already in the form of a book, right? We were running it as an excerpt
from the book. So it had gone through the publisher's...
Right, it had already...
To say nothing of Philip Roth's hands.
Right. So I wasn't expecting to find anything. And also, I was intimidated. And if I had found anything, I don't know what I would have done. But I read it as careful as I could and with great restraint, and I found a little inconsistency. There was a long quote from a children's history book, and it was repeated toward the end of the excerpt, and there was some tiny word change, very minuscule thing. And I think that was the only thing I queried in the whole piece. So I gave my proof to Bill Buford, and his assistant came up the stairs the next day or whatever it was with a copy of the proof, and Buford had written up at the top, Philip Roth on Mary Norris. Who is this woman? And will she come live with me? So I was thrilled. I just came across that piece of paper when I was cleaning out my office the other week.
You have had a great success with this incredibly funny and warm and really interesting memoir Between You and Me. And now I have to say I'm brokenhearted to say you've left the New Yorker and you're as healthy as can be. What are you going to do? You have a new life?
I have a new book to write. I'm going to write a book about Greek. I told you I was interested in other languages and I started studying Greek back when I was on the copy desk of the New Yorker. And when I was tossing around ideas for a second book, it came out that I had written quite a lot about Greek for this book, for the book in English, that, of course, had to get cut because it wasn't really pertinent. So I have already gotten a start on it, I guess. But the book will be about the resonance of Greek, both modern Greek and ancient Greek, in English.
What was the transition like for you, going from editing for so many years to writing pieces of your own and writing a book of your own that said by Mary Norris, not invisible ink, edited by Mary Norris?
I learned the difference between being a writer and being an author. I'd been a writer all my life, scribbling poems and trying to do talk stories for the magazine, and I wrote a novel. I kept a blog, The Alternate Side, Parking Reader. But I didn't have a lot of success getting published. So by the time, you know how old I was when I finally got this book published, I was already in my 60s. I'd been writing for 30, 40 years, and this was my first break. And I had thought, maybe it isn't going to happen. Maybe I'm just going to be a copy editor all my life. So by the time I got the break to do this book, and it was a surprise to me that anyone was interested in commas and semicolons and would want to read about them, I was very thirsty and wanted very badly to be edited, to get that kind of attention from an editor. So I really enjoyed it tremendously.
So, Mary, let's go back. You graduated from Douglas College. You had all kinds of odd jobs here and there, and you were something called a foot checker, by the way, which you'll explain in a second. And somehow you gravitated to The New Yorker. How did that happen? What's a foot checker, first
of all?
Well,
the foot checker, that's right. In Cleveland, the city pools had this system of making sure nobody with athlete's foot got in. So everybody
had to. That
sounds
like a great job.
I never did see a case of athlete's foot.
So you were bad at it?
Then again, I didn't know quite what it looked like.
Yeah.
But it was a good way to get to hang around a pool all summer long, and it was one of the few jobs you could get when you were still only 15 and a half, 16 mm-hmm. in Cleveland. So that was my first job, and I got that job. I wanted that job because I wanted to be financially independent, and I wanted a little cash. I took what was available. And that's pretty much what happened at The New Yorker. I came to New York from Vermont. So I had a sibling who lived in New York, and it was through this sibling that I met Peter Fleshman, who was
the
at the time the
New
owner
Yorker.
Of the magazine. It's just that
made a fortune in yeast.
Their family did make a fortune in yeast. That's true. Big yeast money. Have you seen those old issues of The New Yorker? They were full of yeast ads.
Yeah. How did that happen?
So anyway, I was going to take the test to get my hack license. I thought I might drive a taxi. And when Peter found that out, he said, why don't you call and see if there are any openings? Because I did not know my way around New York. It would have been a disaster if I tried to drive a taxi. And then there were two openings. There was an opening in the typing pool and one in the editorial library. I flunked the test for the job in the typing pool.
Too slow, too inaccurate?
Well, just totally inept. It was on an electric typewriter, and I was still using a manual. But the editorial library, they had big old manual typewriters, and I just had to type a summary of an article on an index card, and that test I aced.
You killed it.
I did. So I got a job in the editorial library, which we now call the archive of the magazine, right?
Right.
You know, it was fun. It was a good job, a good entry-level job for me.
And how did you become an editor? Did somebody come in and say, hey, Mary, do you know the difference between that and which?
Ha! No, it wasn't quite like that. I got a little bit restless in the library after a year or so, and my boss in the library, Helen Stark, agreed to let me go from the 18th floor to the 19th floor a couple days a week to read foundry proofs. That is the last stage before it goes to press. So I made a catch on one of those foundry proofs.
A correction.
I made a correction.
What it was?
It was the word flour was supposed to be F-L-O-U-R. It was in a shopping for food column, and it had been spelled F-L-O-W-E-R.
You can't have that.
No, and it had gotten all the way through a whole lot of different people, so that was where I made my mark.
That's where greatness began. A little flour.
It was still a couple years before I moved out of the library, though.
Okay. Now, there's a very important passage in your book, and it's about editing my colleague, Kelly Fasana, and you write, at the time, I did not know that there was an informal contest going on at the magazine to see which writer could get the most instances of then you use the F word, Mary Norris, into print. And that Sane was going head to head with the editor of The New Yorker, David Remnick, for the title. Do I have such a potty mouth in print?
As I recall, you had just written about some people who had a tendency to use strong language.
Yeah.
You write about boxing. You write about Russians.
Yeah, well, guilty as charged. When you started the magazine, the editor of the magazine was William Shawn, who was famously allergic to obscenity on the pages of The New Yorker. What was his thinking about it, and how did that change?
Well, I think, to put the kindest construction on it, William Shawn just thought there should be other ways of expressing yourself than just always swearing. Mm-hmm. And so people would have to give some extra thought to how they could say, you know,
those things
that have four letters in them. And
did you find him that he was right or kind of a little stodgy?
Well, I found that he was stodgy, but of course I respected him. What was funny about him was he was squeamish about all bodily functions, you know, all of the
blood was not allowed.
No.
Fishing, dead animals,
right.
Nothing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he had this allergy also. He was squeamish about, for some reason, the word wigs.
Wigs.
And twins and midgets. There were just things that he reacted to that he would just take them out. And sometimes it wouldn't make any sense that to the writer.
No wigs?
No wigs.
Wow. Wow. When did the floodgates open when it came to profanity? Late 70s, 80s? What happened?
Let's see. What was the first piece? I think it might have been you.
Now, is grammar something that people knew to a far greater extent earlier and it's being lost? That's what old people always think. Or is it just something that's shifting all the time and maybe older people are stodgier about it and younger people are more flexible?
I think that what you said is true, that it is shifting all the time. I think an older generation got a more rigorous education in grammar. People used to be taught Latin and Greek, right? And then they would diagram sentences in English. And I think now the classes are called language arts, and I don't think they learn a lot of grammar. I don't know how much it matters, really, because grammar is something you can learn by osmosis, just by what you read. If you pay attention to what you read, you know, and if you read good things.
But in matters of law, there's the Supreme Court, there's the Constitution, there's a code of civil law, all the rest. How is this decided in matters of the English language? Who decides?
Well, the people. It's all about usage. Common usage is what eventually carries the day. You know, we can complain all we want and try to make things correct if we think they're not right. But if people continue to do something a certain way, eventually that's what's going to be right.
Well, I love the book, and it's wonderful to talk to you, and I can't wait for the next one. Mary, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, David.
You're fantastic.
I'm going to miss you.
I'm going to miss you. Mary Norris, The New Yorker's one and only comma queen.